I mean, I think that if the question is how to improve public polling, right, it'd be almost like don't do it.
Welcome back to Crosstabs, the podcast that tries to explain how polls really work and what they're really for, so that the inexorable march to November can be just a little bit less baffling. I'm your host, Farah Bostic, founder of The Difference Engine, a research-backed strategy studio helping leaders make big decisions. Each episode, we take a look at the art and science of polling, but no takes, no spin, no predictions. Last fall, I heard an episode of The Ezra Klein Show called Are Democrats Whistling Past the Graveyard, featuring the political strategist Mike Podorzer. And I found myself, as someone more steeped in qualitative and observational research methods, compelled by his realism and his humanism in thinking about people and about voters. Mike has been in politics since 1975, mostly in the labor movement. He recently retired as political director of the AFL-CIO, but he is far from idle. In addition to all the work he does for progressives and the labor movement and in defense of democracy, he is also the publisher of a Substack called Weekend Reading. He is skeptical of polls, but his skepticism comes from a place, I think, of knowing how much better and more useful polls could be if they only bore a greater resemblance to how we actually vote. So here's my conversation with Mike Podorzer. Tell me about your background. What are you doing now and what were you doing before you started Weekend Reading and some of the other projects you work on?
My career's been in politics. I've been doing it since 1975, most of it in the labor movement. Recently retired as political director at the AFL-CIO. During my time there, I really took a great interest in increasing our ability to understand how politics work and what works, both at tactical level and strategic level. Been instrumental in starting a number of organizations along the way, including Catalyst, which is the national voter file for progressives and labor, the Analyst Institute, which is dedicated to understanding what works and what doesn't. More recently, the Research Collaborative, which focuses on how people understand and are processing the rise of fascism and threats to democracy here. The Defend Democracy Project, which provides sort of strategic communication and works with the media and press on those issues. In the last few years, I've also started writing a Substack, Weekend Reading, where I talk about all those kinds of issues.
How did polling play a role? Like that feels like a thing that people come to talk to you about quite a bit. It's a thing you did for the AFL-CIO. How did you get into polling?
I feel like I've watched polling progress and then regress. Polling a few decades ago was mostly understood to be a tool, a very useful tool in running better campaigns. It was one tool in a toolbox that helped people who were campaigning figure out what to do and what's working and that sort of thing. Over the last decade or so, as it's become just ubiquitous in the media, it's been used as now sort of the only way to understand what's happening in America. And that represents a real departure in sort of epistemology from sort of all of human history. And it's really taking the political debate and people's choices about how to show up in this fraught moment in very dangerous and wrong directions, because it's such a limited tool and it has such weaknesses, such known blind spots.
You wrote about this in one of your posts on Weekend Reading, A Cure for Mad Poll Disease, which is talking about other evidence like administrative records, other sources of data, real world observations, and a variety of other things. And it made me think about the turn from almost kind of ethnographic statistics, you know, information about the state, into this very quantified thing. And then later, obviously, polling and surveys and that sort of stuff. What do you think is driving that? Why? I mean, it seems obvious to me. I went to journalism school. It seems obvious to me that you wouldn't report on a single source. So why would you report on a single poll?
Right. And I'm glad to hear you say that, because it is striking how the journalistic standards that serve, I think, us very well like disappear when it comes to polling.
Mm.
Right. I mean, like at the extreme, it's a media organization does a poll, it comes up with some crazy result. And if you continue your analogy, it would be like you had a source who told you something that was fantastical. You wouldn't feel an obligation to report what the source says because you heard the source say it. And yet the media outlet would feel it had a responsibility to report the fantastical poll. You know, it's really, it's ridiculous, right? I mean, if you remember about a month before the 2020 election, the Washington Post said Biden was going to win Wisconsin by 18 points. And the New York Times said he was going to win it by 10 points. And he won it by less than half a point a month later, right? You could know that was ridiculous, but the media is really, really is a blind spot there. And I think part of it is that numbers have a kind of seductive effect, both on media decision makers, but, you know, all of us who aren't vaccinated against them, because they just seem like certain in a way that something else never can seem as certain. I mean, a number is a number in our heads. And the number, like, how do you argue with a number? And yet, the New York Times did a really fantastic, probably the best piece of data journalism in history in September of 2016, before the presidential election. They did a survey of about 850 voters in Florida between Clinton and Trump. And what they did, which is kind of genius, was they got four other very reputable, not, you know, out there spinning pollsters to take those 850 interviews and come back with their assessment of where the presidential race was. And with those five different pollsters, the four they asked in the Times itself, they thought the race was anywhere from plus four Clinton to plus one Trump, right? So, and given your people who are probably interested in this, really sit with this, right? There were no methodological issues about collecting the data because they were all looking at precisely the same 850 interviews, right? And there was nothing in the inherent political biases of the people doing it. The only difference was their good faith differences of opinion about how to weight the sample. And so what that ought to show people is that polling is not much different than taking five experts, putting them up on a, you know, stage and saying, hey, how do you think Florida's going to come out? You'd probably have the same range of opinion. And you might even have had someone having trouble saying they were thought Trump was up one. But still, the point is that we know how to hear those five pundits or political scientists or whatever on the stage. We understand that kind of uncertainty, but we don't when it comes to a poll. Because in that instance, and you know, like the Times has become kind of a periodic mood crusher as they release their polls, you know, you know, they could have in that month just released their poll and everyone would have thought, oh my God, it is exactly what they thought the race was, right? And it's not. And it's even more so that it's problematic because it's, especially if you haven't done a lot of campaigns, like really been in a political campaign, you really don't appreciate the sort of longitudinal instability of polling, right? You look at the polling and say, oh my God, he's down by 3 points. How will I ever get over that? And you fast forward in your head to that's what it's going to be now 6 months from now. And it just has that effect on how we think about things. And in some ways, that's, you're sure starting with like the least of the problems with polling. And because that just is probably responsible for, you know, in the general public, responsible for more visits to psychiatrists or something, right? For anxiety relief, you know? I mean, it gives us all something to be anxious. oh, we forgot to be anxious about who's going to win the presidential race, right? It solves that problem. It reminds us we need to worry about it. But it's also very dangerous because, for one thing, the idea that who's going to win the presidential race or any of these things is knowable now is inherently demobilizing.
Yes.
Because it suggests that, like, it can be, it's already done, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than seeing that, you know, what polling is somewhat useful for is to remind us that all these races are close, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to let people take this argument to extremes. It's not like if you did a presidential poll in California today and you saw how far ahead Biden was, you would say, well, we don't really know. The problem with polling in this case and in almost every case where people care is that it can't be precise to the level you want, right? If it was obvious what was going to happen, you wouldn't care to poll, but the poll would be right, right? If it's something that you really care about because it's so hard to know, then polling isn't capable of telling you, right? Mm-hmm. And so you just kind of become more of a junkie.
So I live in Suffolk County, New York. The presumption is it doesn't matter how well-liked Nancy Goroff is or how charismatic John Avalon is, it's going to be Nick LaLota again because we vote for Republicans every time. But at the same time, the registration of voters in Suffolk County is pretty high rate of registration. It's evenly divided. It's a third, a third, a third, Democrats, Republicans, Independents. For LaLota and the other Republican candidates to win 57, 58, 60% of the vote in Suffolk County, basically says to me, Democrats don't vote. Like that's what they have to win all the Republicans and two thirds of the non-affiliateds. And then the Democrats have to go, well, it's a foregone conclusion. There's no point. And also it's New York. Who cares if there's one Republican in the, you know, there's more than one Republican right. in the congressional delegation, but there's sort of a, you know, everybody turns out and votes against Kathy Hochul. That won't really have an effect from Suffolk County because New York outweighs. And it has that kind of, like you described it as a kind of stealing of oxygen, sapping of agency, right. that there's just this sense of the foregone conclusion, that there's no real need for my vote here because it's obvious what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But I think there's also an anesthetizing that happens when it's too close, where it starts to feel like such a nail biter that it can be discouraging. In some kind of way. And the more they ratchet up the drama about it, the less in control of it a voter might feel. I don't know if I'm projecting that. I don't know if I'm just talking about my feelings.
Yeah. I think that and there's a lot there. The polling has effect on different actors different ways. Mm-hmm. For individual voters, it's, I think, much more complicated than what you're describing. There's a substantial portion of the country that is habitual voters. It literally doesn't matter what's on the ballot. Every other year, or for some people every 4 years, they go and vote regardless of how close any races are, whether there's anything worth voting for. And looking at the voter file, those voters, if you voted in the last four elections, regardless of your demographics or any other factor, it's a 95% chance you're going to vote again. Right. Those people vote. And so you have to take that chunk off in terms of thinking of the effect of anything on turnout. I think it is pretty clear, much clearer now after Trump won, that whether people who haven't been voting go vote is not somewhat localized really to how close the race where you are is. Because voting has other psychic functions for people. Right after Trump won, for many people, it doesn't matter like how close the race was where you were, you wanted to go and vote against Republicans or whatever, right? And another factor is just how much people are talking about the election and voting as a sort of surround sound, and it becomes what you call social proof. A lot of the people who don't vote all the time don't make their decision on the basis of what they think, but they make their decision on the basis of what they see their friends and family doing. And that way it's kind of contagious. I bet if in mid-year last year you did a survey on which football teams had the most fans in the country, San Francisco and Kansas City would not have been 1 and 2. And yet more people watched this Super Bowl than any other in football history, despite way more popular teams, people, you know, all of that, because Taylor Swift was going.
Yeah.
Right? And that made it a social thing. It had nothing to do with like what people anticipated it to be a good game or not. Right?
Right.
Voting's a lot like that. And even without a Taylor Swift, which is kind of, I guess, Donald Trump in this analogy, it still is the case that the habitual voters are the people who watch football every Sunday, mm-hmm. right? The others are people who show up for the Super Bowl party, right?
Yeah.
And are really sensitive to how cool a party it looks like it's going to be. And I think also now these days, just the clear stakes have a lot more to do with whether people actually show up than what too many campaigns sort of put a lot of effort into, which is saying, oh, your vote's going to matter. Your vote's going to matter, right? At a certain level, we all know it's almost impossible that our vote will matter in the sense that the election will be decided.
It'll be determinative, but, yeah.
Right. Where the polling does matter, and this is these are the places where it's really important, it determines which races those with a lot of resources put resources to, right? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of the parties, outside groups, stuff like that. They can decide to like go to your district or not. And there it's a more calculating decision where polling is an input.
There's a, what is it? Vote Save America, the crooked media thing.
And yeah.
I was just curious, like which districts are in there. And there are districts on Long Island that are in their investment yeah. cluster. Mine's not one of them. I understand why. The margins are tighter in Nassau County. Like it's a closer run race. It feels therefore more winnable. But it is interesting to think about how those investments get made based on what the polls look like.
I think to a great extent, the polling in our current era has worsened those kinds of decisions because the very sort of fallibility of them creates illusions of winnability when they don't exist, right? Mm. And end up sending literally hundreds of millions of dollars to the wrong places. And it comes from another one of sort of implicit assumptions in the way polls are interpreted, which is that sort of whatever that set of 1,000 people or whatever are thinking that day is kind of like sui generis. There's nothing you need to know about what that person did in the past or like the context that they're going to be making their decision or any of those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're deciding that instead of sort of looking at the whole landscape, you're going to get yourself a pinhole to look at it through, right, then you can think that Jamie Harrison could be Lindsey Graham. You could, you know, believe all these things that you really wish would happen, but that if you actually step back, right, the idea of him winning in South Carolina would have been so ahistorical. Like, what would that actually look like? And that's a problem.
Well, and I wonder about, well, I have two things I want to ask you about. So maybe I'll start with this line you wrote in Madpole Disease Redux, which was, Americans know the difference between answering a survey and casting a ballot, even if the polling industrial complex and pundits don't. I think that is when you actually talk to voters. I've done a handful of voter focus groups. Like, I think that's observably true when you're talking to them. My example for this is always the handful that I did was in the early-ish spring in Pennsylvania. And so when you go to the Philadelphia collar counties in April and ask people how they're doing, and that was the question I asked, how are you doing? Someone in every group shouted out, potholes. Potholes is not usually an answer to the question, how are you doing? I'll start there. But secondly, of course, they're thinking about potholes. They just drove the turnpike to get to this focus group facility in the suburbs.
Right, exactly. Right? Yeah.
And it's April. Right? The roads are terrible in April.
Right.
But that's not when they're going to go vote for governor or whatever the race was that we were looking at that time. So maybe talk a bit about what that means, knowing the difference between responding to a survey and casting a ballot, because I think it's a really important distinction that gets lost.
The most immediate to what everybody's like stressed about is the presidential election. Mm-hmm. So there are a few different ways in which it's not the same thing. One is that they ask you, if the election were held today, would you vote for Trump or Biden? Right. Now, the election obviously is not being held today. Right. If the election were being held today, we would have all been punished by at least a month of wall-to-wall advertising by both candidates. The contest would have been sort of the main focus of the news in that period of time. People would be talking about it, right? So right off the bat, it is kind of anti-democratic in the sense that we have elections on a particular day because we want to hear both sides and have campaigns and things like that. And so, not that I think this is necessarily the best way to run a country, but the way we do is these, you know, episodic judgments, which are structured to happen every 2 years and are set up to be the result of this vigorous debate that goes on before them. And so, right off the bat, it's not the context. You can see it in the most recent Times polling or any polling that people are much less informed about what's going on than they will be in October. You know, it's as almost as sensible as asking people in the preseason who they think is going to win next year's Super Bowl. The information they need to make a really good judgment is just not available yet. Second reason that it's problematic is that when you have an incumbent versus someone else running, but as you're taking the poll, right, if you're not someone who's engaged really in following politics all the time, and we're seeing this clearly, is if you're just kind of unhappy with the way things are going in the country, and you voted for Biden in 2020, it's pretty easy for whether you're going to then say you're undecided, speaking of Trump or something like that, to just do that because, you know, you're just bummed about stuff, right? But that's different from your state of mind on election day, on the actual election day, when you actually are going to think a little bit more about what it would mean if Trump won. You may not be any happier about it, but you're still understanding that there's like something at stake. There's nothing at stake when you take a poll. This is not just the case here, but if you look at approval ratings for chief executives around the country, right, around the world, I'm sorry, right now, you see that Biden is almost the least unpopular world leader at this moment, right? The world just in a funk. And that's not to say that there aren't real problems. Polling is picking up that disappointment people have in the gap between their expectations for their lives and the lives that they're leading. That's getting rolled up in it as well. The other thing that's really important, and it's about the difference between taking a poll and getting into a hypothetical, is that we humans are terrible at anticipating our future behavior and opinions. I mean, just it's in our DNA. It's very, very difficult. If you did a survey of smokers, say, and said, will you be smoking in a year or something like that? Like you would always get more people saying they were going to stop than actually do. Where it plays out really powerfully in politics and where polling has had a really important impact on how we're governed. A great example is abortion. For more than a decade, polling told us that the proportion of Americans who felt this way, that way, whatever the choices were, was really stable, and that overturning Roe was not a political issue. And so you had, you know, the organizations that wanted to protect women's right to choose always under this disadvantage of being told that raising it would only backfire. The reason is that when people were asked, would you vote against a candidate who was for overturning Roe? It really never showed statistically as being that important. And the reason was that no one believed that Roe could be overturned, right? So no matter how much you were asked to put yourself in that hypothetical, you really couldn't, because you didn't underneath it believe that it was possible, right? That anyone would do that, that people saying it were doing anything other than being rhetorical, right? Mm-hmm. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that it didn't work out that way, right? That Roe was overturned, and it's the most salient charged issue of since then. And it would have been before it as well if people believed that that was actually up for grabs. But if you think about the media coverage for the Gorsuch or Kavanaugh hearings, the voices that were saying this is going to overturn Roe were all sort of muffled by the media because they didn't believe that that was actually what this was about. To get the original question, why it's really problematic, it's that because people are not able, right? It's not like they're like trying to put one over on the pollster. It's the pollster putting one over on themselves, right? Yeah. To believe that you can ask people the exact question you want to know the answer to, and that they're capable of telling you what will actually happen.
I have literally given talks with this idea in it of in commercial market research, there's a lot of, and I think there is in public opinion polling as well, a lot of concern that the respondent is lying. And my experience with this as a qualitative researcher is when we start getting to inaccurate reporting from people, it's because I've asked them a question that's too hard to answer. Like it's something that they don't know what time of the day they typically log into your website. Yeah. Check your analytics. Stop asking them. Like, this is not a, exactly. I don't know. So they're going to think, well, I think this morning it was right before breakfast. I think I had breakfast at 8. Yeah. So it must've been like 7:40. Maybe I do that every day. I don't know. Like they sort of speculate, but without any kind of anchoring or context. And it's just, it is very interesting to think about, you know, would you vote for a candidate who's threatening to do X or Y without assessing their estimate of the probability that that thing would ever take place, right? Like, right. I think there's a certain amount even in the polling now that's like, and you wrote about the kind of media's obsession with horse race polls normalizing the abnormal. I think there's even a kind of suspension of disbelief that bad things can happen more than once. You see some of this in the kind of, at least the explanations for why people are like, yeah, I didn't vote for Trump last time, but I think things are bad now under Biden. So how bad could Trump be? Well, you know, you either have evidence of how bad you think Trump could be or not, right? Like, right. You lived through it. He's not a challenger brand specifically. So there's a kind of anchoring that doesn't take place, or a grounding that doesn't take place in the way these questions get asked. And so then we backfill it with some speculation about why people might feel this way.
In 2004, what we're talking about right now about believability came home for me, which was, this was when I was at the AFL-CIO. And as many pollsters do, we'd ask, what are your most important issues? And Social Security was always pretty high up there, right? It was important to people. And we would do testing, mail testing on different issues in Social Security. At that point, Bush had been talking about privatizing Social Security in the second term, and it never moved the needle. He gets reelected, and starts the process of privatizing Social Security, and opposition goes off the charts, including among all the people who were not moved by our exhorting them about him going to try to privatize Social Security. And really from that moment on, I realized that when we think about communicating with voters, that we're so handicapped when the only thing we're researching is what we should be saying, rather than what needs to be made believable. And that whether or not it's believable is really the threshold for whether anything you say is going to matter. There's an easy solution, which is you just ask the battery twice. And the second time around, you say, how likely is it that this is going to happen? Mm-hmm. And then you got like a nice 2x2 plot, and you can sort of begin to make a more informed decision, right? So mm-hmm. it's possible to work around it, but still to this day, very few sort of go to that expense. On the larger question, I think the reason that we're in this position where there are a lot of people who should say exactly what you said. It's like, well, you know, I really am unhappy with Biden, but, you know, we got through Trump. How bad could it be? And that informs their opinion. What's missing there is the way the larger information system they're situated in functions. Because one of the challenges with Trump and MAGA and what they're doing is that if what they're saying at any point is true, right, which has always been the case, yes, that is exactly what they want to do, then people look around for the reaction of the people around them to see whether they're as freaked out as they are by what they just heard. Mm-hmm. And when they see no one else is freaked out, they say, you know, well, maybe I'm misunderstanding. And that's sort of the problem. It's like, you know, the frog in the water, right? Where it's just getting warmer so slowly that you don't notice, and then you're boiled. In this moment, it's more like you look around and you convince yourself it's just a sauna you're in, right? You think it's getting warmer and warmer, and this is kind of bad, but you look around and no other frogs are jumping out. So you say, well, it's a sauna. And you just sit there, right?
Yeah.
That's where a lot of this comes from, right? This Joe Kahn, who's the executive editor of the Times.
Trust
the New York Times, right?
Yeah.
Because the New York Times has certainly done more thorough, groundbreaking work on what Trump is up to, what he's going to do, like all of that. They have massive resources. And it's as if the people who make decisions about how to talk about this election or what gets on the front page or whatever, just don't read it, right? Don't read their own newspaper. The example I used was this very deep, well-researched story about all the specific plans that are already been laid if he's reelected to deport 11 million people, including where detention centers are going to be set up, how the military is going to come into cities to round people up, all of that. That is like one of the worst things that would have happened in retrospect, you know, 10 years from now, if it actually happens. When you look at the history of it by a factor of at least 5, bigger than any other kind of similar expulsion or in U.S. history, there's no follow-up, right? And beyond that being a first-order problem, the second-order problem is even people who read the New York Times unconsciously discount the importance of that original story because there's nothing next. You mm-hmm. just go on to the next thing. Now, if you sort of contrast that with people who are in the Fox information bubble, that is not a problem, right? Mm-hmm. They have one storyline: Democrats are ruining everything, and every piece of news reinforces that. While it's false information, the many people who showed up at the Capitol on January 6th, now I'm not talking about the guy with the Viking hat or some of the Proud Boys, but the rank and file people who were there in a world where what Fox was reporting was true would probably be you or me. Mm-hmm. People who really did care about this fictional country, right?
Right.
That they were going to defend. And that doesn't happen symmetrically because in our information system, all this stuff is constantly debated, right? Mm-hmm. Are they really going to do this? Well, they're really not going to do this. And so it's really difficult for people who have not been paying attention not to do where you started the question, which is you do know that you went to the grocery store and, oh my God, this thing that you needed is now more expensive.
Right.
So how bad could Trump have been? And so, of course, you're going to say that. The other thing that sort of wraps in here that is important in terms of how people looking at polling think about what's going to happen is that the pollsters have, for this particular kind of election, two kinds of questions. There's one, which is, who do you think's better on issue A or B? Mm-hmm. Who's better for the economy, Trump or Biden? And now I'm limiting the discussion to the respondents who matter, the ones who are not just like completely going to do Biden or Trump no matter what, and right. are not up for grabs. We're talking about the maybe 10% who like really are up, maybe 15. But for them, right, when you ask, say, a Gen Zer who never had a regular job, is like juggling two different jobs, that sort of thing, who's better on the economy? That is a question that had never occurred to that person until the pollster asked them. And so they're going to answer something like, well, it sucks now, so I guess, you know, Trump must have been. I'm equally confident that in October, they're not going to like look at their bank statement and think, oh my God, I need to vote for Donald Trump so that I have more money in the bank or something like mm-hmm. that, right? There's like no connection. On the other hand, that voter will or won't vote if they believe they're going to lose their health care if they don't, or if they think abortion is on the table, something very specific that's more analogous to a ballot initiative, where it won't even matter to that person if they can even remember that 6 months ago they told a pollster they thought Trump was better on the economy.
Yeah, they're not holding themselves to account for the thing they said to a pollster 6 months ago.
Right.
Yeah.
But for those voters who are not habitual voters, it's saliency rather than some calculation about ideological affinity or mm-hmm. all the issues that they've worked on, not going to be the reason they decide to vote.
So talk about that, because I think the world I live in, salience matters a lot. And, you know, it's about standing out. It's about giving people a reason to do something. That's right. Something that brands spend a lot of time thinking about or should be. But it seems like it's the thing that doesn't get asked very often. I have seen it a couple of times recently where they'll ask about your top issues and then they'll ask a question that's something like, you know, some people have a subject about which if a candidate disagrees with them, they absolutely won't vote for them. And that reshuffles the deck every time. I kind of laughed because I think the day of or the day after that Semaphore piece with Joe Kahn talking about, well, you know, immigration's the top issue or inflation's the top issue right. in the polls. It's like, well, A, depends on which poll you look at. B, when you ask a question that's more aimed at salience, you get a completely different ranking of the issues. And so suddenly the issues that he thinks aren't very important get up into the top five. You know, democracy and abortion are suddenly up in the top five. That decision making is based on some sort of abstracted ranking of topics, as opposed to what is actually going to motivate me to vote at all, and then for one candidate or another. So maybe talk about that. And what would be a better approach to getting yeah. that salient?
No, it's another great topic to focus on. So we, like in almost all cases, have no idea what the most important issue to us is. And it's also, in a polling sense, an inherently problematic question for the purposes you're talking about. It's an area where the difference between people who use polling like I did and have a lot of resources and what media polls do is very, very important. So you were just talking about how at one point in time, these are the issues, then it gets reshuffled and all of that. And all of that leads to a rhetorical fallacy, which is voters now care more about this. That's mm-hmm. the story you see. The accurate statement is now more voters care about this. But the way we process that information, it's as if that issue is becoming more important to individual people. Then you deconstruct it. And if, given that we were saying before that maybe only 1 out of 7 or so people are actually up for grabs, you are reporting a conclusion that is pretty much driven by what partisans say are the most important issue. If Republicans decide that it's immigration and not crime, then the way the result of the poll is reported makes it seem like we all now think immigration is more important. So it's a complete mess.
I think that's a really interesting distinction. I was talking to someone else about these rankings of issues as well, where the most important issue, which is the wrong way to describe that, the most commonly selected issue, the most commonly selected issue is still only ever selected by 30% at most of the respondents.
Right.
So it's not widespread. It is not reflecting that everyone thinks this way, first of all. And secondly, it is not a measure of intensity. It wasn't asked on a scale, right? It
was exactly.
Like, how important is it? Yeah.
Right.
And
exactly.
I think that gets confused in the reporting a lot.
Oh, always. And it's symptomatic of a handicap that media pollsters have that, if acknowledged, would sort of make the whole effort not worth it, which is to do the kind of poll that would overcome many of the kinds of problems we're talking about is a multiple in terms of cost of what they do, right? In terms of the number of interviews needed, the number of people to real experts to analyze it, and so forth. But they keep sort of deciding that in the face of each of these kinds of critiques, that it's still better than nothing, right? And it's just not. Now, if like in the world of sort of campaigning, you would be doing the kind of poll we're talking about of just people who might change, right? Which is much more expensive. But the assumption that the media implicitly makes is that somehow having the weight of partisans' opinions being 6 times the weight of swing voters' opinions still gives you a reasonable thing to say about the people who will change. No matter what issue set I'm going to give on a given day, I'm not going to vote for Trump. But my answering what my issue is influences what the media is going to say is the most important issue.
Yeah.
Right. And just not. The thing on your original question, though, that salience is that it is one of the things that is really difficult for humans to convey accurately in a single poll. We've learned that asking people, will this make you more likely to vote or not, has no predictive value over and above whatever they've actually done that can be known on a voter file. But people really want to know who's going to vote and all that. You know, you need it, so you go for it. So that's kind of the problem, is that you can't know that. But if you step back, we actually do kind of know it without polling. So if you think about CRT, for example, at first, if the Republicans were doing a poll and saying, how important is CRT to you? Like zero. No one knew what it was.
Yeah.
It wasn't affecting people. In page one of the Republican playbook for half a century has been put Democrats on their back foot on race. Find something to say about race that Democrats will feel defensive because they are concerned about their own coalition. So what they do is use polling to figure out how to make CRT salient, not to figure out how to message CRT. And they tried lots of other things. And that's not what progressives do or what Democrats do. The way they use polling is to figure out what to say about CRT. Most of the messaging research is about how to talk about the thing they don't want to talk about because Republicans are making them talk about it. right?
Yeah.
Rather than how do you make the things that they don't want to talk about, right?
Right.
And
it's messaging instead of strategy. And
yeah, exactly. Exactly. So to like go back to our abortion part of the conversation, that has always been something that you could backfoot Republicans on, but there wasn't a confidence, a strategic understanding of that, that then let them do the same thing to make clear where Republicans were on abortion. We've sure gone like many miles on like this question, but the real answer is that you can't poll for salience. You have to strategically figure out what people need to know and believe, right? Another great example of that is that in 2004, the Bush campaign really understood the fact that Kerry had been a distinguished Vietnam War veteran and Bush had avoided the draft was problematic. And so you had an outside group, Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, who did these ads making lots of false claims about Kerry's service. It was the kind of thing where like the first ad had no impact. For a long time, it had no impact until it was repeated and unchallenged enough that it basically collapsed one of the pillars of his campaign because they understood strategic objectives rather than being in a sort of, I'm going to wake up in a Groundhog Day kind of way every day and figure out, well, what should we talk about today, right? And what incoming is there? That's what polling does too. That's really problematic, is that it basically takes strategic thinking off the board.
To bring it back into briefly sort of the public pollster sphere, you know, there's a whole other thing that's going on with the campaign's own pollsters. But I think one of the things that you had in one of your pieces, terrible food in such small portions.
Yeah.
One of my favorite lines. The idea of trying to avoid some of these pitfalls where, and obviously like in the mind of the New York Times, the mind of Joe Kahn, he doesn't have a strategy, right? There isn't a strategy he's trying to affect apart from writing things that people want to read. And that obviously can become the view from nowhere pretty quickly. But there are other ways of getting to something where if you're really dedicated to the idea that what your strategy is giving voters the information they need to make a decision come November, if that's your purpose,
right?
You have some interesting recommendations about ways to do that, ways to actually give people information that is usable, actionable, that it matters. And some of those things have to do with whether you poll swing states or the whole country, how you set poll in context, how big a sample size ought to be. But maybe just talk a little bit about what, you know, if you were going to try to improve the situation for public polling.
Oh my God.
I mean, in 2 minutes, can you just tell me how you would fix it?
I mean, I think that if the question is how to improve public polling, right, it'd be almost like, don't do it. I mean, some of the just threshold errors that are made, the first, that all the things we've already talked about today, but also, and it's actually kind of surprising it's taken this long to get here, that the national poll makes us believe that national polls matter. We are one of the most extreme federalist republics in the world, which means that the sovereigns in this country are states. Senators come from states, members of Congress come from places, electoral votes come from states. There's no national vote on anything that matters. Mm-hmm. And yet the implicit assumption of all national polling is that what we think in the aggregate in this country actually determines anything or should matter. And so from literally the starting gun, right, it's giving you information about a story that doesn't matter. As you could see in 2020, when Biden wins by 7 million votes and we have to worry about who's going to be president. And yet that's replicated in the polling. But what polling misses is that the United States is better thought of as two nations with two different political ecosystems, which gets erased. I'm sure almost everyone probably listening doesn't realize that a white non-college person in a blue state voted more for Biden than a white college person in red states. The regional difference in everything is enormous. And if you look at urbanization of the 17 blue states versus the 25 or so red states and put it in an international context, the blue states, and remember, this is not cherry picking, this is a country, would be a country with about 140 million people, right? Would be almost the most urbanized country in the world. If you look at the urbanization of red America, and there you have about almost half the country, it is literally between Bulgaria and Iran.
Wow.
In terms of urbanization. When you do say, look at this national result, you're saying, look at a poll of Bulgarians and Brazilians. It would not compute to us. And yet we insist on believing that there's just one political ecosystem, that everything can be understood in an interchangeable way wherever it is in the country. And that is a real problem. There are just so many ways in which polling gives us a map where we can't help but get lost if we're trying to get to a better country.
Crosstabs is hosted by me, Farah Bostic. Production by The Difference Engine and edited by me. Music from Audio Jungle by S Audio. Find us at crosstabspodcast.com, where you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter and find out immediately when new episodes drop. Tell your friends about the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast service, drop us a note if you have any questions about poll design or sampling or weighting or anything else, and we'll see you next time.